of more political experience. Is this a particularly hard thing to imitate? Or is the experience of the post-classical period, where politics clearly lagged behind culture, is this simply confined to that period and no longer applicable to the world today? I don't have an answer to this question, but I think the post-classical patterns do pose an intriguing question. The post-classical period saw, obviously, a great deal of deliberate and a substantial amount of successful imitation. New connections were forged between societies in which civilization was a new phenomenon and societies in which the patterns were better established. These connections were never complete. These connections never erased issues about civilization definition, as between Russia and Byzantium, Japan, China, etc. But the fact that the questions could be raised at all suggests the importance of the imitation process. And one final point is equally obvious. All, at least three, of the major cases explored today involve societies, Japan, Russia, and Western Europe, that during the post-classical period itself were clearly somewhat on the peripheries of the most sophisticated patterns available in the world at that time. They did not have as advanced economies. They did not generate the goods for trade that the more established centers did. And as we've just been discussing, they clearly fell short of the political standards of China, the Caliphate, or the Byzantine Empire. But these three societies, and possibly Southeast Asia should be tossed into the mix as well, would use this period of imitation as gestation for a later emergence in world history in a much stronger fashion. And thus we see this period not only as one of imitation, but one of unwitting preparation of societies that would later play a much greater and more independent role on the world scene.
Lecture 15, Western Civilization in World Context.
The great Indian leader Gandhi, according to the story at least, was once asked what he thought about Western civilization, and he replied, "I think it would be a very good idea." He presumably was questioning, at a time he was in struggle with the British, whether the West was civilized. He presumably was not questioning whether the West was Western. I want to use the discussion today to muse a little bit about Western civilization in the world history context. We'll be focusing on two topics primarily, both of which have a bearing on the West as part of the post-classical world. The first topic is when an identifiable Western tradition can be uncovered and what it consisted of. And the second, more focused, involves situating the West in the post-classical world. We've already begun that process last time by talking about Western Europe as one of several imitating societies with some distinctive twists, but part of a larger pattern. And we'll certainly come back to that notion, but I want to add some issues about particular patterns of Western trade and particular patterns of Western dynamism toward the end of the post-classical period. The relationship between the history of Western civilization and world history, we've already touched on. It is, frankly, complicated. You can't do both exactly at once. At least you can't do a full Western Civ program in the framework of world history, because the result would be to crowd out other societies or to view other societies either as irrelevant or as worth noting only when they're in contact with the West. And we've already seen that world historians really think that's a bad approach. It's almost better to stick to the West itself and not pretend you're dealing with the world as a whole at all. I want to be discussing today not just the issue of how much West can one deal with in a world history program. I want to be talking about what I think is a more subtle but also very real issue involving the Western Civ tradition when looked at through world history. And that's the extent to which the West is sometimes viewed almost unanalytically as if it's a given that requires no particular thought. We can begin the discussion by situating the West among certain other kinds of definitional issues we've already evoked. I would argue, for example, and all of this is open to discussion, I would argue, for example, that it's harder to pinpoint the Western tradition, its origins, and its precise characteristics than it is with regard to China or India. China obviously has a tradition that goes back to, presumably to the Shang dynasty, certainly to the classical period, and it always involves certain elements of the state, Confucianism, certain aspects of a technology tradition, etc. Indian history does not necessarily effectively go back to the first civilization on the subcontinent, Harappan civilization. We don't know about links there. But certainly once Indian society gets going in the classical period with the caste system, with Hinduism, with certain characteristic political features, you can start talking about an Indian tradition that's identifiable in its linkage between the classical period and today. Vastly changed. I mean, neither of these traditions, neither the Chinese nor the Indian, is static, but there's a clear pattern. Western civilization, it seems to me, is more complicated, partly because of the fall of the Roman Empire in the West. It is, of course, common and justifiable to go back to the classical period in looking for the origins of the Western tradition. And elements are certainly going to be there, either because they persisted despite the fall of Rome or because they were later revived. But there are also two problems in looking at the classical period as the origins of the West, and these need to be noted as well. Problem number one, we've emphasized before, but it really bears repeating, is the extent to which the classical Mediterranean tradition fed not only the West, but also a number of other societies, Eastern Europe, quite obviously, the Arab world as well. This fact makes it a little bit difficult to pull out exactly what's Western in this tradition. For example, classical Greek and Hellenistic science unquestionably had a lingering influence, an impact that survived the classical period itself, but we've seen that this tradition was actively taken up in the Arab world, and in a sense, in the post-classical period, Western science, partly because it copied the Arabs, was really part of a scientific community that was indeed partially derived from Greece and Hellenism, but was widely shared and not distinctively Western at all. Later, arguably, the West will produce a more decisively different scientific tradition, but at this point, frankly, it's a bit hard to pull out. The same thing holds to the great debate between rationalism and faith. This was a debate that turns out to have been shared in the post-classical period in Islam and in Western Christianity alike. Interestingly, it was not a debate that particularly affected Eastern Christianity. In other words, there's heritage to the classical tradition, unquestionably. It's not always distinctively Western. The second problem in overemphasizing the classical origins of a Western strand, the second problem involves how much of the classical tradition did not survive, or at least did not survive in any direct sense. Take a simple but not insignificant example. Classical Greek and Roman attitudes toward homosexuality did not form part of the West's later tradition with regard to homosexuality. It was a very different pattern. Whether the pattern emerged at the outset of Christianity or only later in the post-classical period has been debated, but there's simply no classical connection to characteristic Western attitudes toward homosexuality insofar as this forms a part, if a subterranean part, of a Western tradition. Or take that staple, and here I'm going to be very candid, I'm editorializing a little bit. Take that staple of American education, the notion that the West's democratic tradition goes back to Greece and Rome. Okay, Athens had a democracy. It's not exactly the modern form of democracy, but that's quibbling. It was a democracy. Rome had a subordinate democratic element in its republican constitution, although its main emphasis was on aristocratic rule. So, unquestionably, there is a democratic strand in the classical Mediterranean past. It was not the predominant strand, but it was there. Unquestionably also, By the time one gets to the late 17th, 18th centuries, and Western thinkers are beginning to think about democracy again, they will hark back to Greco-Roman example. I don't think this caused their thinking, but it certainly provided some rhetorical cover, and in that sense, there is a tiny bit of connection. But we're talking about a gap of almost 2,000 years between the classical instance of democracy and anything like the contemporary Western one. Where's the filler? Where's the connection? Frankly, there isn't much. Democratic ideas appear in the West almost not at all in the post-classical period. There is a brief possibility in one popular rising in Rome in which classical traditions may have been still evoked and remembered. But the notion of a Western strand of democracy stretching from the classical period to the present, I think, is at the very least highly debatable. And in my view, it's a non-starter. It's an historical distortion. It's understandable because it lets us think that this political system we value today has these really venerable roots, but it just doesn't work. So if the classical period raises two crucial kinds of questions about Western origin, what are the options? Nobody's denying, by the way, that some segments of the classical past would survive or be revived and would form part of the Western self-perception. I don't think, to take another tack, I don't think that defining the Western tradition, defining the West as a civilization, is as problematic as, say, defining Japanese or Russian civilizations, issues we talked about in our previous discussion. Japan raises huge questions about whether it should be seen as a separate entity, as a civilization, or as part of a larger Chinese-influenced East Asian whole. That issue does not clearly arise for the Western case. It's true, of course, that one needs to think about some common aspects to Christianity, which raise questions about the boundary lines between the West and the larger Christian whole. But on the whole, it seems to me most historians have been reasonably comfortable in arguing that the marked divisions between Western and East European versions of Christianity, which were sort of ratified and solidified in the 11th century with the Great Schism between East and West, these divisions in doctrine, in church organization, in church-state relationships, in religious artistic traditions, in philosophical traditions, these divisions make it fairly clear that the Western tradition is not Christianity as a whole, but a subset of it, initially, obviously, organized primarily by the Roman Catholic Church. So we're skating here between two levels of definitional difficulty. My argument is that the West is harder to define as a civilization tradition than India or China, or maybe even the Middle East, but easier than certain cases where imitation was even more rampant, as in the Japanese instance, or possibly the Russian. I would argue, and this brings us back to the period we're examining more generally, I would argue that it's in the post-classical period specifically that one really finds some distinctive features that become demonstrably Western and fairly durably so, although, of course, they too will change over time, just as is true with any civilization tradition. And if this is so, what are these features? Let me suggest three or four. First, in the post-classical period, obviously, the West was defined by Roman Catholic Christianity. So there was, in that particular version of Christianity, the origins of some distinctive Western features, and there was also an organizational basis that one can look to as well. Obviously, the Western tradition of Christianity posited a certain degree of separation between a distinct church institution, a distinct religious tradition, and political structures. Now, these distinctions could be blurred. In point of fact, states often muscled in on the church, and the church often muddied its own waters by calling on state aid when it might have been better suited to try to solve its own problems by itself. But the notion of a distinctive version of Christianity and a partial separation between a religious sphere and a political sphere strike me as one element in what one might call an emerging Western tradition, different obviously from the East European Christian tradition, but different from Islam and other parts of Asia as well. Second component, the post-classical period, through the particular Western form of feudalism, its dominant political system, not immediately but ultimately developed a clear, if at this point pre-modern, parliamentary tradition. Feudalism was ultimately taken to read that rulers had something of an obligation to consult with their vassals and possibly other elements of their constituency in making certain crucial decisions, particularly where taxation and budgets were involved. This parliamentary tradition, which flowed out of Western feudalism, it didn't result from Japanese feudalism, which had a rather different, if equally important, later heritage. This Western parliamentary tradition shows up in Spain, in England, and elsewhere by the 13th centuries and becomes a durable part of Western political structures most of the time thereafter. There are other traditions in other parts of the world that also involve consultation with councils. One doesn't want to overdo this distinctiveness, but along with church-state relations in Western Christianity, I would posit this as at least a possible defining piece. A third component, and this one needs to be stated particularly carefully, involves the political power and independence of Western merchants as their traditions emerged in the post-classical period as well. Now, the care here needs to be directed toward emphasizing that the West was not the world's commercial leader in the post-classical period. It wasn't even necessarily a leader in capitalism. Islam had a great deal more capitalism than the West did at this point. But what I'm arguing here is that as Western merchants began to gain greater dynamism, participating in trade throughout various sectors of Europe and then even in interregional trade, their vigor, their commercial activity, was less constrained by political regulation than would be true in the Middle East or China, other centers of actually more sophisticated merchant activity, but where state regulation and state supervision were more present as well. Here, then, are three possibilities. Others might add a couple of additional, in addition to church and church state, parliament, and a particular sphere of independence for merchants. Some authorities on Western Europe in this period have argued that Christianity helped the West generate a particular sense of the superiority of man over nature, that would make the West particularly interested in new technologies, not at this point a world technological leader, but particularly interested in new technologies, either of their own invention or as they could be borrowed from other societies. This is at least worth thinking about. And finally, although this one actually develops more clearly a bit later on, there's an interesting argument about a distinctive kind of Western family structure that would emerge beginning at the end of the post-classical period and then intensifying in the centuries thereafter, a family structure in which ordinary people married fairly late, thus having an emphasis on nuclear families, husband-wife families, in which wives and husbands had to collaborate or conflict particularly directly, that contrasted with the extended family traditions that described actually most of the rest of the world one way or another. Here's another interesting Western ingredient, a less expected one, that might be worked into a definition of Western origins. All right. The first issue, then, involves the possibility that we are well served in looking at the post-classical period as really a formative one for Western civilization, in which certain classical traditions could be incorporated or reutilized, in which certain activities developed simply as a result of imitation of other societies, but in which in a few crucial areas of political relationships, social and economic relationships, something of a set of Western themes is beginning to emerge that we can trace from that point onward, just as we can trace Indian or Chinese traditions even earlier on. The second aspect of positioning the West in the post-classical period is, in one sense, an easier one, and we started the process again by talking about the West as an imitator. The West, obviously, if you look at the West in relationship to the other societies operating in the post-classical period, the West was long a rather backward society. Muslims, who were not necessarily totally intolerant of Christianity, tended to look on West Europeans as clumsy, unsophisticated, possibly good warriors, a somewhat football player image of Western society that we perhaps have retained traces of even today. This was not a Western civilization that commanded great respect in Islam, and doubtless the Muslims were being unfair, just as we've returned the favor in more recent periods, but the sense of a serious civilization gap was perceptible and, to some extent, defendable in terms of the West's position in world affairs. The West, obviously, many Western leaders in various spheres of activity, felt this gap directly as well. This is why, among other things, they proved such eager imitators. This is why they frequently traveled to other places in Muslim Spain, in the Byzantine Empire, in Egypt, and were filled with awe at the standards of living, at the urban cultures they encountered there. This is why the Crusades, called obviously in a burst of a sense of religious superiority and obligation, called to urge Western leaders to retake the Holy Land from Islam, this is why the Crusades actually ended up having their primary impact on the West as a revelation of the gap between Western living standards and those of the Middle East, as a spur to new levels of Western trade and Western consumption. Western society in the post-classical period poised, I think somewhat uneasily, between a firm conviction, sometimes pressed to the point of absolute cruel intolerance, a firm conviction that this was a society that possessed essential religious truth as no other society did, on the one hand, and on the other, a nagging sense that despite this religious superiority, in virtually every other aspect, this society was somewhat backward, somewhat lagging. The West also faced a particular issue that we need to discuss a little bit today and then come back to as we go back to a larger world schema. We've seen, and it's quite obvious, that the West participated actively in post-classical trade, and this activity increased as Western society gained vigor, particularly from about 900 or 1000 CE onward. Western merchant activity pressed into the Mediterranean. Italian ships, particularly from Venice and Genoa, began to carry trade actively in the Mediterranean, ferrying passengers and goods from Islamic societies as well as from the West itself. The West entered increasingly into interregional trade patterns, but it did so with two obvious disadvantages. The first is fairly well known but deserves emphasis, and that was the extent to which it inevitably, for some of the goods that were most sought after in the West from interregional trade, it inevitably depended on Islamic middlemen. Western traders had to go to Egypt or to the Eastern Mediterranean in order to seek the goods that would come from India, from China, or the Middle East itself. And this meant, A, quite simply in terms of economics, an additional price to pay to an additional series of middlemen, but even more, it meant the necessity of dealing with emissaries of a religion that was viewed as heretical and inferior to Christianity, an awkward cultural position as well as a slightly awkward economic one. The bigger problem, however, was what in modern parlance we would call a balance of payments issue. The West wanted goods from various parts of Asia. It wanted spices, it wanted silks, etc. What was it to use to pay for these goods? Western manufacturing, offered almost nothing to world trade. It was a manufacturing system that improved during the post-classical period itself. Textile products became better. New kinds of woolens were introduced. So within the Western sphere itself, there were clear manufacturing gains, but this was simply not world-class manufacturing. The West had no distinctive minerals or agricultural products to offer. There was a little bit of gold available, and the West had some silver resources, but it was not nearly as well endowed in this regard as, say, Africa was. So the West faced an obvious dilemma. It wanted goods that it had difficulty paying for in terms of the strengths of the Western economy itself. A revealing moment occurred. Now, this is strictly slightly after the post-classical period itself, but it carries the themes onward that I'm discussing here. A revealing moment occurred when the Portuguese explorer Vasco da Gama rounded the southern tip of Africa and reached India in 1498-99. He brought with him on this first trip some Western textile goods, woolens, that the Indians didn't want. They had much better textiles. He brought some crude metal pots and products. Indians didn't want those. They had much better metal products. He happily did bring some gold. This they did like, and this allowed him to purchase enough to take Indian products back to Portugal and persuade the king that a regular series of voyages would be desirable in the future. Without the gold, he would have been lost. And, as we will discuss later, when he went back the second time, he had a remedy. But it was not a remedy that reflected any particular European economic gains. Europe then existed in the post-classical world as an increasingly eager participant in larger Afro-Eurasian patterns, but a participant at some disadvantage, either because of the greater recency of cultural and political and economic achievements, or because of basic resource position, or both. One response, and this is clearly emerging in the post-classical period itself, one response was to become particularly eager imitators of developments, and particularly technological developments, elsewhere. And here, to a real extent, the West would luck out. Toward the end of the post-classical period, two things happened that began to create new opportunities for the West. In the first place, regional competitors, particularly the Byzantine Empire, to a lesser degree the Arabs, regional competitors encountered some new difficulties. Arab political unity shattered. The Byzantine Empire declined increasingly to the extent that Western trips actually raided Constantinople during the Fourth Crusade. This may have relaxed some of the tension on Western Europe, but the more important point was that new opportunities arose to borrow major new technologies from other societies that could help the West over time answer the question, how do we get out of this fix? How do we more clearly match our sense of religious superiority to our relationships with our neighbors? How do we resolve the balance of payment problems in ways that will allow us to participate more successfully, more freely in larger world trade? The imitation opportunities occurred vis-a-vis the Middle East. And from the Middle East, we've seen the West eagerly borrowed a number of technological and cultural devices. But opportunities also opened up in new Western connections with China. And from China, at the end of the post-classical period, the West would take a number of technological items, the compass we've mentioned before, but the great ones were explosive powder, invented by the Chinese and used by them for military purposes, but on a somewhat limited scale. The West would learn about explosive powder, would adopt it as their own, and would, by the early 14th century, begin to add formally made guns to the utilization of this powder, guns and cannon, in ways that differed from Chinese patterns. And the